Interview your personal biography first, but where you were born and when?
I was born on February 2nd, 1921, in Winnipeg, Manitoba, at 806 Central Street.
Okay, and what was your father's occupation?
My father was a foreman boilermaker in the CPR shops.
Okay. Now, can you tell me something about your early life, your schooling, and...
Well, I went to elementary grade and ended up by... Went to grade 11 and quit school in the Depression years. I quit school in 1936. And I went to work, delivering a bike for $8 a week. I left that and went into the Capital Carpet Company in Wellington in Toronto and started weaving carpets. And I was a rich boy around the neighborhood because I was making $18 a week at that time in 1938 and 39 when war broke out.
Okay, when war broke out, I guess you volunteered, did you?
No, I was in the Royal Winnipeg Rifles about 2 years before the war. You could go down once a week. In the summertime, you could get away on a holiday, go to camp for 2 weeks, the only holiday you could because you couldn't go away. On the cause of the Depression days, you get a break by going to Army camp for 2 weeks and you get some training as well. When the war broke out, the Royal Winnipeg Rifles didn't mobilize, so the Grenadiers were mobilized, so I went and joined the Winnipeg Grenadiers.
In what rank?
I joined it as a private.
Mm-hmm. And can you give me a bit about your early training after you joined?
Well, the early training in Manitoba didn't consist of very much. Just that we took the Vickers machine gun and drilling on the Price Square and Minto armories. Then we moved from Minto over to Fort Ogden Barracks. And we didn't have much training over there. Being at practice, we never knew at that time about grenades. Just before we went to Jamaica, that they started teaching us about grenades. But I had been very fortunate. I knew a lot about grenades and weapons before I joined the Winnipeg Grenadiers because I had my training in Royal Rifles.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll move into going to Jamaica.
Yeah, I was on the first draft and left Winnipeg for Jamaica in 1940, and with that, going down to Jamaica, as a few got off, a company got off, a company, if I remember right, got off in Bermuda. And they were there for, maybe for about a year. Then they come up to Jamaica to give us a hand. Before they arrived, we had a bunch of reinforcements arrive from Canada because the men were getting sick of what they call dengue fever, and we had a guard duty performed. You come off of guard duty, you had government house detail, and government house detail, you'd move on to a ship's detail with American ships or ships that weren't at war would come into the harbor. We'd have to board them and search to make sure there was nothing on board that they could bring into port.
Okay. What was life down in Jamaica?
Life down in Jamaica was a paradise. We were guarding a bunch of internees, and we went down. We were there for quite a while. We left Jamaica to go down to the Dutch colony to pick up a bunch of prisoners. We brought them back, and away coming back, we ran into a tail end of a hurricane. But on the whole, it was a nice trip if you like the sea life.
Okay, so how long did you stay in Jamaica?
I was in Jamaica about 18 months.
And can you give me some details about the return trip to Winnipeg? How did you come?
I come back by boat to Montreal. We come from Montreal down into Winnipeg. And we were let off at the CNR station, and we marched down to the Robertson building where they give us 30 days furlough. But I never did get my 30 days furlough because after about a week after we were back, 2 weeks, we were... And now it's going out over the air that all the Grenadiers report to barracks immediately. But I said, to hell with it. I wasn't going to report. I was going to have my furlough and have a good time. But it so happens I was picked up by the military police when I stepped out of Hudson Bay Company and put in the barracks. And 2 days later, we left for the voyage over to Hong Kong. At that time, we didn't know where we were going. We were just sent down to the Pacific coast of Vancouver, and we boarded the Iwatia. Well, the first meal we had aboard the Iwatia was tripe for supper. Well, it was very disheartening when we looked at the ship and the conditions of it, that we just decided that both of us were going to walk off the ship. Well, a couple of CNCOs, they figured they're going to be smart. They put a guy on there with a Tommy gun. And we just took the Tommy gun, and we knew it wasn't loaded, so we pushed the guy aside and walked off. After about an hour or 2 hours on shore, the officers talked into us to coming back on board. But previous to going down to Vancouver, we had quite a few people that jumped off the train and just wouldn't go to on board the ship. Didn't know where they were going. They didn't want to go. And we, after we come back home, we found out all these guys were served 30 days detention. They were all promoted to sergeants and staff sergeants and CSMs. So I might as well just not have gone to Hong Kong. I had got my rank.
Well, okay, can you tell me a bit about your arrival in Hong Kong?
Well, when we first arrived, and the way going over, there was quite a bit of excitement there one night. Well, we was going over, we arrived at Honolulu, and nobody knew that we were going to Hong Kong. Then we got down to, on the way to Manila. On the way to Manila, a fellow by the name of Roy Robinson spotted the telescope of a sub. Well, it was. This caused quite a bit of action on board the ship, and the I forget the name of the escort that we had on the way going over. And anyway, he got recommended for some award for being observant, seeing the American submarine come out of the water. But the same night, we went through a pile of Japanese Navy. We didn't know what the hell was going on. We just looked and figured they were on maneuvers. Nobody bothered because we didn't know that Japan was going to declare war or even thinking of war. We heard rumors they were talking, but nobody thought they were going to go to war. And when we arrived in Hong Kong, well, we just took a look, and we had quite a march down to Camp Chapo where we were staying. We were put in camp or confined to camp for usual routine when you get down there 3 or 4 days. But we didn't stay in the camp 3 or 4 days so much. We just broke out that night and went downtown to see what it was like. When we found out that it was paradise, said it was quite a paradise place. Or we give our money and put down two bits. You'd order a dollar bill and you tell them to bring some beer. And of course, they bought a big tray of beer there. We wondered what the hell was going on. Whether somebody else was treating us. But we found out that we could buy all we wanted for a dollar. We could buy a pack of cigarettes for a nickel a package for 20 cigarettes, Canadian cigarettes, which we were paying 2 bits a packet for at that time. And we thought it was great. And the nightclubs and the meals were something to really have a good Chinese meal, and it was something different, and we really enjoyed it. But then we went back to camp. We had over a camp for a couple of days there. We had a what they call a boy coming in and cleaning up the camp, and the boy would wake you up and shave you before you woke up in the morning, hang all your equipment, make your bed, and clean your head up. Well, we decided it was, we were getting paid there one day, so we all decided there were about 30 men in the hut. We all chipped in, we gave them about $3 or $4 a piece. So we give them this, I think you end up with about $200, I remember right, not Canadian money, Chinese money, and that afternoon we're looking for the boy, we couldn't find him anywhere. So a British sergeant come along looking for him to pay him what he was getting paid by the British Army, which wasn't a hell of a lot. I think it was maybe about $2 a week in Hong Kong money. And he asked where he was, and we told him we hadn't seen him. So he asked what we had done, so we told him what we collected. He said, oh, hell, he won't be back. He's going to work for somebody else, because now he's rich. And the funny thing about that there, we didn't know at the time, we had a Japanese officer selling pencils and pens in front of our hut to us every day of the week, and shoelaces with shoe polish, whatever he wanted. And he made out that he was deaf, he couldn't speak English, he couldn't talk or couldn't hear you, but in the meantime you're taking everything that was said.
Was there any type of training done in Hong Kong after your arrival there?
Not too much training at all, because what they're trying to do is familiarize us with the island of Hong Kong. We were sent over there looking the island over, putting a pillbox, and this is where our defense was going to be for coming out, as we see coming at that particular time. And actually, nobody paid any attention to it because there was talk of war, but we had one sergeant major by the name of Friday. And he said, if the Japanese ever did declare war, there'd be no way you'd get off the island. And we all laughed. He was an old man. He was in the British Army during the First World War. And we figured, what the hell, Japan is not going to declare war on anybody. So we just forgot all about it.
Okay, now the beginning of the Japanese bombing. Can you give me your reaction to it and the events?
The reaction to that bomb is that, but before it actually was what happened, quite a few of the boys were downtown one night. And we got in a big fight at the Sun Sun Club. And we kicked the shit out of the British troops down there at the time because we were friendly with the Indians. And a fellow by the name of Red Windsor was the one that actually started the fight. There's different versions of who started it, but it was Red Windsor one of the British troops said to him that Canadians were all nuts. They didn't give a shit who they were drinking with. So we took exception to this, and we told the British off, and no one took concerns, and it started a big fight. Well, it cost the Canadian government like $75,000 in further damage done to the Sun Sun Club. So the next night, they're walking down the street. The British were on one side of the street, and the Canadians and the Indians were on the other side of the street with the Chinese, and that was their. We go anywhere we wanted to go on the island, nobody bothered us. And it was something that you think back on. No, you have to laugh at it because there's so many damn people there, you couldn't got hurt anyway.
Okay, what happened when the bombing started?
Well, when the bombing started, I got just that morning, that day before that, I was sentenced to 7 days in the guardhouse for being AWOL when they put this finished bringing my breakfast into me in the guardhouse with a fellow by the name of Roy Stodgell. And of course, him and I were always in the goddamn guardhouse, even down in Jamaica. But then we looked up and we saw all these planes going over, and we said, well, Christ, thank Christ, the British are getting some planes in here. We'll have some maneuver that looked like a maneuver. Then the bombs started dropping, and when the bombs started dropping, the cell we were in was so damn old that the bombs opened the cell door, so we walked up because everybody was hiding. So then we knew that the first time we knew that war was actually declared.
So what happened, what did you do after you got out of the guardhouse? Where did you go?
After I got out of the guardhouse, I went over to my company and I found out my company was moving out over to the island of Hong Kong. We're told to withdraw and get over to the island of Hong Kong, but I decided I wasn't going to go over there. I wanted to go where the action was, so I just took off and went a different way. Yeah. Frank Brown, him and I went one way, and we saw a little bit of excitement, and we enjoyed ourselves. We went sat downtown in the bar, and we got drunk. We went to the hell with it. We weren't interested in this. And, of course, you know, the usual thing the Canadian soldier does, you look for girls. We found them, and we had a good time. But 3 days later, we went over to try and locate our company, and they were all withdrawn across the other side of the island. And we commandeered this truck because we decided we weren't going to walk anymore, and we took this truck. We finally found out where our company was and went into the battalion headquarters, and they told us to go down to where our company was in Aberdeen Reservoir. And this is where we went. Right down in Aberdeen Reservoir, I was sent up to the pillbox to be there for a while, and I got sick of that. And we went and moved over to Mount Cameron, and we had to fight a battle there. This is where the Japanese suffered severe losses. And it's something today when I went back there in 1966 and took a look at it, I thought, my Christ, how did I ever walk up to that top of that mountain to fight the Japanese army? But it took me a long time to get up that hill, but it took me a hell of a lot less time to get down because I rolled myself in a ball and just rolled down the damn hill because they're coming over so fast and so thick everybody had to get out of there. And I left there and went down to Mount Bennett. On Mount Bennett, the Japanese were coming across on Mount Bennett, and we started fighting there, and we thought they were coming behind us. Here was an old troops firing on us, thinking we were the Japanese, and we were caught between two fires. And then we moved from there, we went up into Aberdeen Reservoir. And we left Aberdeen Reservoir, there wasn't much doing there, because we were all tired, and we didn't have any food. We went down to the town of Aberdeen, and we went to go to sleep in the barracks down there. fellow by the name of Spanky McFarland come in there with Lieutenant Campbell, and he said, we have to go back up to defend Mount Bennett. Well, we're up in Mount Bennett, we decided we needed some water. No water, we had all the whiskey we wanted to drink back from our cooling our Vickers machine gun with whiskey and not with water and rum, because this is all you had to use. So we looked down, we saw this wagon down there full of fresh water, so three of us volunteered to go down and get it, and only two of us made it back, but the other chap was killed with a bombing down there. And we got within about, well, we got a few water bottles full of water, and we were headed back out when the Japs bombed and blew up the wagon. But when we fell down, we get up to go again, we noticed one fellow had the top of his head blown off right between us. Just, I guess, one of those face of wars, you know, when the time to come, you get it.
So, was there any more fighting before the ceasefire?
Well, there's no such thing as the island of ceasefire. I think that by this time we knew that we couldn't carry on very much longer because we were all tired. And we had no water, we had no food, and it was just a matter of time before the Japs would take the island. The order comes through that the island would not, we wouldn't call it surrender, we capitulate it. We don't like the word surrender. And we're told to lay down our arms. We took the Vickers machine guns, we took every park and scattered them around the hill. Any rifles were long, we took the bolts out and threw them away so that the arms would be no good to the Japanese. And then we walked down through the Aberdeen Reservoir, and then we surrendered. Not surrendered, we capitulated, because went down there, and the Japs come and picked us up. They lined us all up in line, and they took a look at us, and the ones that didn't seem to like it, the ones that seemed to be scared, they bayoneted it. And there's no way you could stop them. So we figured, what the hell, if I'm going to go, we're going to, we said, one another, well, if he's going to bait it anymore, we're just going to turn around and fight them back. But there was no more of that. They took us on our march, which we marched around the island for about two or three days before we finally got where they wanted us to go to. And anybody fell out of line, there was nobody, how they couldn't get them in time, the Japs came along and just put a bayonet in them, and they didn't care. All they wanted everybody to keep walking. And we moved into this house, and I think there's about 50 or 60 of us shoved in one room with a woman in there. She had a baby born in that room. And we just camped ourselves to make sure that she had her baby and she was helped. And it's one thing I'll never forget as long as I live.
So where did you finally end up?
I ended up back in Champshire Pole, the first camp I went into. The camp was blowing all to hell, and we had to make our living conditions there, which was not awful. And we stayed there, I guess it'd be about maybe 2 or 3 months, I don't know, it's so long ago. Then they moved us over to North Point Camp, which was the all-Canadian camp. And we had some officers over there, and previous to this, the officers we had in battle, I wouldn't go walk across the bloody street to see them today. Some of them were completely, the senior officers were completely yellow. All they think they're doing was staying in the pillbox and hiding themselves, so I have no use for the senior officer, the junior officer, we had a hell of a good bunch of junior officers, and NCOs were excellent.
So what was life like in North Point Camp?
Oh, life wasn't much different than anything else. We decided that we'd, the Japanese, some of the guys got a hold of some baseball equipment, and we played the Japanese in baseball, and we beat the shit out of them, and they turned around and beat the shit out of us because we beat them in baseball, not by... In sports, they just take it out on brutality and slam the hammers around, and they want to face the game next day. And of course, the Canadians were all known as being stubborn, and they would turn around and they'd beat them, and they'd kick the shit out of us again the next day. And this went on back and forth. So one day, we were all getting too goddamn weak to finally beat us, and they all give us all cigarettes because they finally beat the Canadian playing baseball.
What was the food like?
Well, I don't know what you call food. You were eating rice and buns that there's that today I wouldn't even give you half a cent for one. I wouldn't even look at it. But at that time, they tasted like honey donut. If you'd open your bun up and you had some beetle in it, somebody said, "Jesus Christ, you're lucky you got some meat for dinner today."
Was there any sickness at this time?
Yeah, the sickness started getting in. We had men come down with malaria. with dysentery. And it wasn't any at that time, there wasn't any diphtheria. Diphtheria started taking place after we moved back to. No, the sickness happened before that, before we went over to North Point. It happened in Shamshapur, when men were dying of diphtheria. When a man died of diphtheria, there was nothing you could do, but we had men that volunteered to go in and give the Dr. Crawford and Dr. Banfield a hand with the sick. And these men were, what I consider, were very brave to do this, because they were all a band. That time we had field training in the field of medical, which were able to help them quite well. They didn't know that they had didn't care for their own life. They wanted to help their fellows in sickness.
Was there any medicine? Was there any shortage of medicine?
Well,
we didn't have
any medicine. What medicine the Japs brought in were really, really needed for the sick. Dr. Crawford was told that he had had so many men on a work party. If a man had dysentery, and he'd ask him how many times he'd gone to the bathroom, the man would say, "Well, I've gone 30 times to the bathroom." He says, "When you go another 15 times, come back and see me. I think you better go on the work party." And today, when I sit back and look at what the sickness our men went through, and I haven't been off work sick for years. I felt like staying home from work, but I just haven't got the heart to stay home, because I don't feel that sick that I can take a day off. Where normally my wife said I should have been in bed, not gone to work.
What did you think of the Japanese at this time? The Japanese?
We thought of the Japanese at that time that they're very brutal. They call them the goddamn Japs. Every time we see one, at that time we had a knife, we could have got away with it, we would have killed them. But if you killed them, then they would have turned around and killed maybe four or five of us for one of them, so we figured, well, it wasn't worth it.
How long did you stay at North Point?
Well, I'm just taking a guess now. Let's say this has happened over 31 years ago. I stayed in North Point about 6-7 months before I shut down. It was on the first draft that went into Japan.
Did you go from North Point to Japan?
Right, North Point right to Japan.
And what was the trip there like?
Well, the trip on the boat going over wasn't any picnic. You were just jammed down the hold. You had to have a ship and leak and get your food all in the same hole, and there was no getting out of it. And if we'd have been bombed or torpedoed, there would have been a man alive, because you're just shut down in the hold and your food was let down to you, and everybody got their share of the food at that time. They took the healthiest men on the first draft to over to Japan.
How many were there?
I'd say another guess, maybe 150, 250. I don't think there's any more than that.
And what about your arrival in Japan?
Well, the arrival in Japan was great. We got off the boat at Nagasaki. We were all lined up. We were given a big hamper, buns, and cigarettes. We thought, Jesus Christ, we're glad to be in Japan. At least we're getting fed now. Well, then we realized the food that they gave us was to last us for 3 days. Nobody told us that, and that was it. When you got that food, you didn't get any more. You got a box of frog's legs, and if there was frog legs, there was sugar-coated beetles and different other vegetables that we never even tasted in our life before.
So where did they take you from Nagasaki?
I went down to Camp 3D Yokohama. And we got in there, and then they started interrogating us, what kind of job did we have in civilian life, and then they separated us and went out to the, went down to the shipyard. The first job I had in the shipyard was working as a welder, which I'd never welded before in my life, but I soon learned how to weld. Then I took sick, and I went into camp, and I stayed in camp for about 2 weeks. And I come out of the camp, went back to the shipyard again, they put me on a riveting gang. And I learned how to rivet. And while we were riveting, we thought, well, how the hell are we going to, based on an inspector, come along and test the rivets that we put in to make sure they're good in the bottom of the ship. So one day, we said, hell, we know what a way to fix this. So when the riveter, we take a chop and mark it with an X, and the riveter inspector come around, we say the man had been around. Well, the first ship that was launched, it turned over and sank. and they blamed the Koreans that were working on the same ship with us. So after that, they turned around and put the Koreans on another, on working on other ships, and left the Canadians working on their own ship. So if anything happened to it, they know who was responsible. At that time, they didn't know who was responsible.
What was life like in this new camp, the 3D camp?
Well, if you call one day every 2 weeks off is a rest, and I guess it'd be all right. You bathed after you take your turns. The Japanese would be the soldiers would be the first one to have a bath. If your turn was first, and you get the hot water after it. But when you had maybe 250 men bath, and then you took them by sections, and if your section was last by the time you got in the water, you can imagine additional water after not having a bath and staying there for 2 weeks with no soap. You just had to do the best you could. Well, we used to swipe the soap. When the ship went down, we used to take that soap home and back to the camp. We used to wash ourselves with it. Well, that stuff was like lye, it would burn you.
What was the food like? Was there any improvement? Or did
no,
it get worse?
No, there was no improvement in food. If you call it potato tops, bamboo shoots, fish heads, that's food, and rice, this is, you can enjoy it. But even today, I still like rice now.
Was there more sickness at this time?
Well, the sickness that you had, you know, no more than you had when you're in the Camp Chapor in North Point, because this is where the malaria, the beriberi broke out. Where there's three types of beriberi. One was called what they call the hot feet, that your feet were always on fire. It was what they called the dry beriberi. The wet beriberi, you had to swell up like a balloon in time. If you kept swelling, everything with your intestine would come together and there'd be no more, and you would die of it. And then you had the, what they call a cardiac beriberi. Your heart would just swell up and blow and just choke everything out, and that was the end of a man. But the sickness, we had a lot of sickness in camps. This was to be expected. You had no medical supplies. Going back to Hong Kong, we were there, and Dr. Crawford asked for more medical supply, and he was a big man, about 6'5", 6'6". The Jap was maybe about 4 feet, four and a half feet. He had to get a box to stand and hit Crawford in the face to tell him he wasn't getting any more medical supplies. And of course, Dr. Crawford from this day has no use for the Japanese. I know this because I was back with him in 1966 in a pilgrimage to Hong Kong, and we went to Japan, and the way that he was talking to him, that he still had no use. Jap didn't get out of the way, he just pushed him out of his way. And I can't blame the man because he took a lot of punishment.
He was in your camp, was he?
In Hong Kong. But he didn't go to Japan. Dr. Reed went to Japan with us into Yokohama 3D. He was our camp doctor. He is now practicing in Vancouver. He has a tremendous practice down there.
So, what did you think of the Japanese at this time? Was the treatment getting worse from them, or?
Well, the treatment wasn't getting any better. The guards, we had a Japanese interpreter there, and they were shooting all the line how much they were going to take Canada and all this, and we just laughed about it because we had a radio in the camp. And we were getting in news. Well, we knew when President Roosevelt died. We knew when they attacked at Guam. We knew when they took Wake Island. We knew when. How close they're getting, what battles that the Japanese had lost. And you didn't have to be told. All you had to do was go to the work party, and you could see the look on the Japanese face. They couldn't believe that they were losing ships. They were losing these islands, that the war was coming to an end. But nobody knew how soon or how fast it was. When you're in a prisoner of war camp for 3 years, 8.5 months, time means nothing to you, because you don't know how long you're going to be there. If your man made up his mind that he was sick, and you say to you, well, geez, I don't think I want to make it, and the next day the man would be dead. I lost quite a few friends during the war, and I lost quite a few in the prison camp. So the old story goes back, when you lost your friends, you didn't want to make any new ones, because you didn't know if you were going to survive or he was going to die, and you feel that you've lost another friend. So after a while, you just turned and become looked after yourself. You didn't care about anybody else because you figured, well, if I go, well, this is fine. But you turn around and make a friend, and then you have to bring your stuff back and face his family. How are you going to tell him what happened? The man give up, or he just didn't want to live anymore. It makes you wonder. But I don't know. It's man. Even if your best friend died, and he had a better pair of boots than you are. You took his boots and got better pair of pants.
There many deaths in the camp at this time. Was there quite a few dying, or not that many?
Well, there was quite a few dying in 3D at that time. This is where I lost one of my best friends. Yeah, my name was Cecil Lowry. Him and I stuck together. We used to go on work parties together. We used to work together on the same crew with this one Japanese. And this Japanese, well, he turned out to be when we first started working for him. He was hard as nails. And he wanted a job done. We got the job done for him. We knew what he wanted, and we made sure that the job was done. He wasn't a man that was brutal. He'd give you a job to do, and you'd do it for him. Well, just after this, we got our first Red Cross parcel. And with American Red Cross parcel, 10 packets of cigarettes, there's a couple of chocolate bars, and a can of milk, powdered milk. You just put your spoon in, took a can of, taste that powdered milk, it just tasted like you're eating whipping cream. And so I was, next we were trading stuff around, and you get more for your stuff than you could. So before this, I was talking to this Japanese, which was by this time we learned to understand the language quite well, and he's got quite friendly with him. He used to take us for what they call a yasumi arrest, and we got talking to him there one day, and his daughter was very sick. And his daughter was craving chocolate. Well, at that time I didn't know he was getting a Red Cross parcel, so there was two bars of chocolate. It was one square with quite a ration of chocolate. It was this big, thick bar of chocolate. So I put a bar in my pocket, and I took it out and gave it to him. And I've never seen a man so happy in all his life. Well, the next day he came to work. He had extra rice balls for me, and he had cigarettes, which they could get the cigarettes quite handily. Well, I got four packets of cigarettes for that one bar. I took the four packets of cigarettes back into camp. I traded off two packets of cigarettes. I ended up with 10 chocolate bars. So the next day I went back out and I gave him four chocolate bars. And then the first thing I know, I become involved in the black market. Well, I had tins of milk, I had cigarettes, I had bully beef, anything I wanted to eat at that time, because I started going into the black market. But a lot of the stuff I had, I give to Dr. Reed for the men that were in the hospital sick to carry on with them, to give them the nourishment. Because I wasn't sick at that time, I was in pretty fair shape yet, because when I was younger, I was quite active. I didn't eat much in those days, even when I was young. I wasn't like the fellows are today. Depression days, and we just got by the best the way we could. And I didn't require much. And at that time, when I joined the Army, I only weighed 125 pounds. So when I got down to Jamaica, I shot up to 150 pounds. When I got released from the prison camp, I weighed 89 pounds. So that wasn't too bad of a drop. When you have a man weigh 200 pounds, it went down to 99 pounds, you noticed the difference right off the bat. But as far as working for this chap, he turned out to be a hell of a good Joe. And when I went back to Hong Kong, to Jamaica, Japan in 1966, I made an effort. I went down and seen him, and he couldn't, and he looked at me, and he said, boy, talking Japanese, how fat you were. And he asked me where my buddy Cecil Avery was, and I told him he died. He couldn't believe it. He broke down and cried like a baby. But you still remember myself.
What were the burial services like for a prisoner that died in the camp?
Well, what they used to do, they used to put the casket, a wooden box. At the end, they put a bowl of soup on it and some rice. And the man would lay at the end of the room where you slept. They were called a barrack room block. And he'd put them there, and in the middle of the night somebody would get hungry, would not eat the rice. It was just one of those things that nobody cared anymore. And what they did, they took them out and buried them. And probably we understand that the Japanese used to go and dig them up and take the wood for firewood. They weren't given any wood. This is a thing you can't blame them for.
Well, sir, did you get paid while you were working in the shipyards?
Yeah, sure, I got paid, but what could you spend it on? You know, nobody, what good was the money to you? You couldn't spend it, you got paid, but... Yeah, who'd wanted to, somebody to offer you 100 yen or 500,000 yen for a pack, for a cigarette? Well, who'd give them a cigarette? If you could buy a meal for a pack of cigarettes, that's what you're most important. You didn't want money. I've seen one cigarette sell for $500 Canadian. And it just shows you the fellows that didn't smoke were turning around smoking because the cigarettes seemed to do something for them. Don't ask me what it was. I smoked and I wouldn't give up even as in a prison camp. I used to take one cigarette when I didn't have very many of them. I used to roll one cigarette into six just to get the feel of nicotine in my mouth. And used to give me more satisfaction eating a full meal.
How long were you in this camp, the 3D camp?
Well, again, I say I had to guess maybe about, I went there in 1942. I was there till 1940, just the beginning of 19, ended towards the October of 1944, before I moved down to Sendai, which is north of Japan, into a coal mine.
Why did they move you down there?
The bombing raids were becoming more frequent over Yokohama. So they figured, well, they better get us out of there because we'd be seeing too much at that time. So they moved us down to, as I say, to Sendai number one.
How did they move you there? By train or by car?
By train. I was one of the last ones to leave the camp because they moved some of them to different ore mines. They moved some down to unloading ships at different far out ports. I don't know where they went to. Nobody knew at that time. And to this day, they don't know what direction they went when they left the camp, but I know that we went north, as I say, to the coal mine. Well, before we left there, there was a bunch of boots and different clothing that had come in. They gave us the brand new boots, which were made a draw for it. There's so many of us. You wore size 9. There was 8 guys with size 9, and then you might have 2 pairs of size 9, and then you drew for who, so you got the new boots. And it'd be another draw to see who got the next pair of best boots and so on through the line until everybody got their equipment fairly good with a pair of shoes. And this is the way they went through the whole procedure for clothing. They just fitted you, or you're the only one that could wear it, and this is what you got. If you had to be very thin, which we all were at that time, but different bone structure, how tall you were. If you were short like a Jap, then you got the best outfit because there wasn't too many short men like the Japanese. Just the quick clothes you ended up with.
What type of work did you do in the at the coal mines?
With the coal mine, I went there as I learned to be a diamond driller. First, I went there and started mucking. And then I went in there and started being a driller and blaster. And we were given, before we actually went into the mine, they were quite a cagey bunch. And they figured, well, we got to get the healthiest one for the down in the coal shaft. And the ones are not strong enough up on the next level. So what they did when they went there, they decided, well, we thought we knew how the Japanese mine worked, but I don't think anybody did. So we went there, they had us down doing, see how many push-ups we could do. And the one that did the most push-ups, they'd give them cigarettes. Then the ones that fell out couldn't do the push-ups, they didn't get anything. Then they made us carry, they said, okay, you carry so many pounds on your back, we'll give you an extra bowl of rice. So you did this, and they found out this is the way they picked the healthiest men up to go down on the coal surface, which is the hardest job in the mine. Well, there's a fellow by the name of Tommy Sinclair from Selkirk, Manitoba. There's Fred Sildola, a guy by the name of Aggie, I forget his last name now, he's up in Swan River. And myself, we happened to get on one crew. But then they decided, well, we were working for what they call a fellow named the Dwarf. So they figured, well, they better split us up. So I was sent to work under the Gypsy. We had nicknames for them all. And we got along did your work, nobody bought it, but they put four men to a crew. They'd give you a number of tags that you had to get out. They'd say, well, between the four men, you'd have to drill, blast, and shovel, push out maybe 35 ton of coal in a night. And you mine, which would be a 10-hour shift. Well, this is fine. If you had one of those men sick, the three men did it. If you had two men sick, the other two men had to work there and get it out. They didn't give a shit if you worked 15 hours, as long as you got your job done. And this is what we did, because if you didn't, the man didn't get any ration, you knew that the man was going to die, so as long as you were able to work, you helped the man. And this went on until the end of the war. And in fact, quite a few of the boys got beaten up. I got beaten up myself, screaming brutally, with a mine hammer. Because if they catch us sitting down, they didn't figure you sitting down, then you got beat up. All through the prison camp, you got beat up. Even today, a lot of our fellows will wake up with nightmares and their experience of the Japanese, different ways that they would do things. They would say, anybody can play a violin? And I'd say, yeah, I can play the violin. They'd take them outside, make them stand outside for 8 hours and play the violin. They didn't care how cold it was, as long as a man admitted to something, that was it. And then I seen one night when you were having a bath, and instead of coming back to the hut, they made you watch outside, you bare naked through the cold weather. Another guy has got pneumonia and died. But how do you say you're not going to do it? You got a gun behind your back, and you haven't got any ammunition. You're in a strange country where they're all slanted, their eyes are all slanted, so what do you do? You do what you're told to do.
So would you say that the treatment was worse in this camp than the others?
Well, I think it was. The treatment in the camp was that you could go, when you worked down below the shaft, you didn't need any clothes on. All you used to wear, not even a pair of shorts, because it was too damn hot. Then you come back and you jump in a sulfur bath, which is 110, 115 degrees. You can just step in it like there's nothing the matter with it, like you're just having a lukewarm shower. This is the condition that you were in at that time. I think if the war would have lasted another 3 or 4 months into another winter there, which when the war ended in August, none of us would have been alive today. None of the grenadiers or Royal Air Canada would have been alive today.
Were the winters quite severe there? Were they like in Winnipeg?
It's pretty hard to say. Some people say the winter over there is bad as Canada. But depending on what part of Japan you're at up north, the winter was, I guess, be quite severe in the conditions that we, the same as we have here. But if you're down in Yokohama, maybe it runs around 40 degrees, 30 degrees, it's pretty hard to remember after all these years, but you still feel cold because you had the proper foods, you probably wouldn't have felt cold at all. It was just a normal working period.
Was there a lot more deaths at this camp than at the other one?
There was a lot more deaths in the mine, because you had mine cave-in, which fellows were killed, caught in the cave-in, and you're trying to dig them out, but no use, and you got the hell out of there, and you see the ceiling cracking. What are you going to do? You knew the man was dead because you saw him get hit with the ceiling cave-in on his head. You knew that he was dead, and nothing you could do about it, so you had to get out of there to protect yourself.
Was there more sickness?
Quite a bit more sickness, yeah.
What types of diseases?
Well, there's every type of disease you can imagine. My berry started getting worse because you didn't have the proper food, and you had no medicine whatsoever in the camp. You had a Japanese doctor that couldn't care less. As long as you're able to work, he went out. As long as you could walk, he went out on that working party to work.
How far was the mine from the camp?
Maybe about a mile, but you walked it with a pair of wooden clogs on, with probably holes all over your socks, and a pair which you wear here in the summertime, with a pair of light pants, which is in the wintertime maybe 25 below down there, which you probably you felt the cold, but this time nobody cared. You think that we're again to think it was easier to die than it was to live. And as I say, another 3 or 4 months down there, we didn't have been another winter. I don't think you've seen anybody come back. It's a miracle that there's a number of people and men are living today after that treatment and the sickness that they had over there.
Was the end of the war quite near now? Did you get any news from the outside?
The end of the war, well, we knew the end of the war was quite near at this time because we were getting word in, and we knew by the look on the Japanese faces that they were cutting down on the amount of work that they give us to do to take, instead of saying you had to need some 35 tons of coal, they cut it down to 25 tons. Another night, it was 2 nights later, it was cut down to 15 tons. The last night I went to the work party, we got our tickets and they need Kamoka, which is 2 tons of coal. So we turned around and we said, since the war ready, which means the war over. And they shook their head and we knew no way we were going to go down until even a half a ton of coal. This time here, we turned on a couple of the men Japanese civilians that were working down the mine, and we just beat the shit out of them and left them there in the mine. One man was a Japanese, was called the Dwarf. When the boy started beating up, he started fighting back, and he was no coward. So we turned around and he said, I had my job to do, and he said, I was doing it. And this man, the Dwarf and the Gypsy, they worked side by side with you, and they didn't let up either. They weren't men that put you to work and let you work. They were right on that face of the coal mine with you. And the Gypsy, as a matter of fact, was a soldier. He was wounded and come back home. He had no use for war, but he was told what to do, and he had somebody watching him to make sure that we done our job. But he worked with us. As I say, when we found out the war was over and we went back to camp, there were no guards around. We decided to take off and go look for food. We went to a farm, and we finally, after maybe more walking for about 4 hours, we ran into a farmer yard and we killed some chickens. We took them back to camp, we boiled them in water, and we had a good feed of chicken. We didn't even bother to clean them, we had everything that was there. The other amazing part around this, there's no dogs or cats or rats around a prison camp, because whatever was around there, we caught it, we had it. And that was to survive. You might think, how could you eat a rat? Well, when you're hungry, you eat anything.
When the end of the war did come, the guards disappeared, did they?
The guards just took off.
How did you find out? Was there any change in the work at the mine?
Well, we knew that, as I said, the war was over. When we asked how many tons of coal that they wanted to put out, when they said 2 tons, we knew the war was over. And we got outside, there was no Japanese guards around because they put us into the mine. They took off because we knew that they knew that we found out the war was over. We'd come back into the mine. They took off because we knew that they knew that we found out the war was over. We'd come after them. There was no guards left in our camp. This is when we came out, we went back to camp, and a lot of us scavenged what we could. We took clothes out of the civilian houses around there, and we even went up as much to what they believe in their Buddhism. We even took a shit right on there to show our determination that we weren't going to take any more crap from them. And then we went looking for food, we took their food, we weren't interested what they did with it or not, because we figured we'd suffer long enough, now we're going to make them suffer, which today I think was a foolish mistake at that time. But when you're hungry and you're desperate, don't know what the hell to do next, you got to have some food, so you just take it from anybody. You're worse than, you're like a gangster. You just handed a machine gun, you're told you're either going to get food or you're going to die. So what do? You go out and take the food.
When did the American planes start arriving or start flying over?
Oh, I guess it was about a day and a half later. And we saw this Navy plane come over, and the guy swept over a prison camp. And he was throwing cigarettes out of the window, out of the cockpit of the plane. We went and picked him up. And about an hour later, 2 hours later, the B-29s came over. I mean, he started dropping food. Big oil drums of food. So some of the parachutes didn't open. They come down with a bloody big thump right for the roof, some of the roofs of the huts. And they're landing all around the camp. And of course, when they smashed open, you see a bunch of pork and beans and peas and carrots and apricots and, well, you name it, bully beef, spam, or click, what used to be called today, and ham. And all this bunch together, you just scooped your hand in it, and you just jam and everything, and it all went in your mouth at once, and it tasted like something you never tasted before in your life. It's hard to describe now, in case you look at it now, you never do that. And we had the stuff, we bought the stuff back in the camp. We had lots of cigarettes, and we were living like kings. And then we were told that we were going down to into Tokyo. So we boarded a train and we went into Tokyo. Well, we got into Tokyo, well, I guess it was maybe about that time, maybe about 70 of us went into Tokyo. By train, we got off the train, there was General MacArthur there, standing at the station watching all the trains coming in, the prisoners of war coming in. And I think we were one of the first ones to arrive there, and they started playing Auld Lang Syne, and MacArthur turned around and he said, "Who the hell don't know play that song?" Well, the band quit playing that, and he played something much livelier, which we all enjoyed, and it was taken into a big warehouse, and the American Army had a team of medical experts in there, but before you got near anybody, you walked into what they call a debugging unit. You went into this big room, you took all your clothes off, you went into another room, they turned on the steam, and you had a good hot bath, they scrubbed your hair, because you, at this time a lot of men were ending up with lice and bed bugs. Your back was just the one bit marked with the bed bugs and lice that you had on. So they pretty well cleaned us all up. Then they gave us all new, brand new clothing, which felt like silk. New undershorts and new army socks and shirts and American uniform. It really felt great. And then we went in there and we had the biggest drink we could ever have. There was beer, there was whiskey float, and American artists says, "Help yourself, fellas, do what you want to do." So we helped ourselves. Of course, at that time we started drinking beer, we started drinking whiskey, and then we started eating. And of course you start drinking, you start eating, he gets sick. You come back, you do it all over again. You start smoking one cigarette after another. You're trying to do three things at once, which can only normally do one. You either eat, then drink, or you smoke, then have a drink at the same time. But we were trying to do all three at once, and which couldn't be done. And we reflect this time. Then we left there. I was shipped on board the USS Iowa. We got on board there, and then the American Navy started handing us, took the Army clothes off. They said, "You're in the Navy now," so they started giving us Navy clothes. Well, yes, we did, and we enjoyed it very much. Every crew member aboard the U.S. Iowa treated us excellent. They were giving us cartons of cigarettes. The money, we were given $100 a piece by the ship's crew, the purser of the ship. Maybe the 30 of us went on board this ship, and we got $100 a piece. We stayed on board there, about 3 days. We went through quite a stiff, they were giving us quite a stiff medical, finding what was wrong with us, and some of the severely the sicker people were put into a sick bay in the hospital, and they were given different medicines and treatment, a lot of vitamin B shots to bring them back up. And the healthier ones, we were put on board a plane, and we went down into Guam. We got into Guam, and again we entered into an Air Force camp. Well, the Air Force didn't like us with the Army, with the Navy stuff on, so then we had to change into Air Force clothing. So we didn't mind, we were getting all new clothing. We arrived in Guam, we ran into a bunch of Japanese who were taking prisoners of war. And of course we had the Freedom of the Island, we were wandering around, and we had this compound, we come across this work party where the Americans were guarding these Japs, making them do some work, and the American soldier said to us, "These fellows, where he looked at us, well, these fellows just prisoners of war, released us." Yeah, they asked us how long, we told him, and he says, so we started talking to some of the Japanese in Japanese, so he turned around and he said to us, "Do you understand language?" We says, "Yes." He says, "What were they saying when you walked up?" We said, "Well, no good bunch of bastards you were, and if you turned your back, they'd kill you." Of course, the Americans went over and beat the shit out of his ass by this time. We were quite happy, even though the Jap didn't say this. They said, "Here's been some more soldiers." And it wasn't even what they were talking about, but beat the staff of the Americans are going to kill them. But of course, you can make the, at that time, we were ready to kill any Jap that we laid our eyes on after you've been there 3 years, 8.5 months. And you lost quite a few friends over there. You weren't too worried what you said. You didn't give a shit if the Japanese got built up and beat up or not. And then I left there. And I went back. They flew me back from there to Hawaii. I was at the Navy hospital for 7 days. And again, they didn't like the Air Force uniforms on us, so we made it back to Navy uniforms. Which is great. Then we had the island every night. We were allowed to go downtown and visit and see Hawaii. When we were downtown there one night, the American, when you went down and dressed, you had to wear your tie. We were going to wear the goddamn tie. It was quite hot in Hawaii, so we took the tie off, and I went, Helen and my Joe Podolsky, Bert McKinnon, and myself, we were sitting in a bar, and the MPs walked in, and they walked over to us, and they were taking you back to camp. They didn't know who the hell we were. We were figuring out the ship, and they put to have everything done up proper. We said, no way are you taking us back. Meantime, we'd been talking to the bartender down there. He knew that we're prisoner of war on our way home. And, of course, told it to quite a few of the other American Navy and the personnel that were in there, Air Force, there was a mixture in there. And we said, the MPs, no way are we going out of this bar. And he said, oh, yes, you are. So they called in a few more MPs. And first thing you know, we had all the other guys behind us. They said, you're not touching these guys. And this time, the American MPs couldn't figure out what the hell was going on. And apparently, another the officer walked in and he said, what's the trouble here? And we said, well, he told us he's taking us back to camp and we get our ties on. We said, we're not putting any ties on for anybody. And he says, why aren't you? We said, because we've been through this come back from prison camp, we've done everything. He says, forget about it, clean everybody out there. And he turned around and said, give the boys anything they want, charge with the murder, and you sign a thing for it. So we were quite happy on this. And after that, I left there. I went to San Francisco. Well, again, we ran into an army camp.
Did you go by boat or by plane?
No, by plane, right through the San Francisco, all the way home by plane. And again, we went to San Francisco. We ended up just side of Maryland, just on the other side of Alcatraz. And we were treated quite rawly. We were given anything we wanted. We wanted clothes. We were told to go down and draw it. We wanted cigarettes, we were given freedom of the mess to go down and get any cigarettes we wanted. We wanted to eat anytime we wanted to eat. We were told we wanted to go at 3 o'clock in the morning and have something to eat. We were quite free to do so. In fact, this was all the way home, and even on board the ship, if we wanted to go and eat, they told us we could go and eat any time of the night or any time of the day if we felt hungry. The Indians said, if you felt like it, you don't want to eat it, this is entirely up to you, but go. We want you to enjoy yourself. But I say, when I left the prison camp with 89 pounds, by the time I got back to Canada, I jumped up to 150 pounds. It just matter, it was just all bloat. It wasn't what we were eating at that time. And so I went down to, I forget the island, Ailes Island or something, I forget the name, but then we stayed there, and then they put us on a train, and I come back to Canada, but all the way across, the American Red Cross was there. We wanted money, we didn't sign for it, they just handed us money and the cigarettes, and it wasn't one cigarette or two cigarettes, they were handing us cartons of cigarettes. That's what kind we wanted. Whether we wanted coffee or anything we wanted, they were there to give it to us. Then we arrived in, coming through into Vancouver. We got just across the border, and we had a Canadian Red Cross meet us. They offered us if we wanted a cigarette. They gave us one cigarette apiece, so we just laughed at it because we were loaded with that more cigarettes than probably the poor girl had on the stage. And then we went down from there into Gordon Head. While we were in Gordon Head, we were dressed in American uniforms, and they took us into the hospital at that time because they suspected that I had TB, and which I didn't have. They figured I had it, so they had to do a few treatments. But in the meantime, we were allowed to go out at night and go down to the show. And the Canadian doctors told us at Gordon Head, you're not allowed to drink, you're only supposed to have certain foods. And we said, oh, bullshit, we've eaten these foods all the way through and drinking, we're going to carry on and do what we're doing. And we did do it. And they would tell us not to go out and drink, we'd go out and get drunk, that thing, come back and go to the sleep in the hospital. There was no way they could keep us down. And I don't think anybody there, or any of the NCOs or officers, would lay a charge against us because they knew that there was no way that they were going to control us, because if they tried this, then they'd have had a mutiny on their hands in Gordon Head, because we weren't built at that time. We were ready to take orders from anybody. And then we're down there, they started okay, go back into Gordon Head, and get into camp. We get into camp, and they're issuing us uniforms. Well, at that time, they issued uniform, brand new Canadian uniform, put it on our battle dress and our boots. And we had no identification whatsoever. We didn't even have Canada up on our arms or the showing that you'd been wounded or how many years service you had in the Army or anything. So walking through there, and these guys, one was a corporal as a matter of fact, and another was a couple of privates. Look at those goddamn zombies. And this time we didn't say nothing. We didn't even know what the word zombie meant. We hadn't heard it before. So that was about 2 hours later we found out what a zombie was. So at this time we went over, they were called back over to the clothing supply to get our Hong Kong plasters and our Canadian things and our only year service you had in the Army. They were sewn on. Of course, when we come back and walk by these fellows, we stopped and we said, "Oh, zombies." They took a look at us. They didn't say a word. They were full of apologizes. And we told them they shouldn't be calling anybody zombies unless they knew what the hell, who the hell they were talking to. And this time, they say we were ready to beat anybody up, which we were quite able to do because we worked in coal mines and we were maybe thin, but we were still, you know, quite a bit of judo by this time, in which we knew how to use it. In which we did occasionally. And we come back to, let's come back to Winnipeg. And there was a second one home to Winnipeg.
What was the arrival like in Winnipeg?
I come home on the Thanksgiving Day in 1945, October 1945. A beautiful day when I arrived in Winnipeg. So I got home and had so many relatives and friends meet me at the station. I got to my house with one big party going, and my best chum was there. He was served in the Grenadiers, but he was too young, just under the age barrier, to go to Hong Kong. So they told him he couldn't go to Hong Kong. He went to Europe, and he come home the day before. I ride in on the Saturday night, and I ride home on the Sunday night. And of course, him and I, he went down to the station. Went back to my house, and we decided to leave my house with my brother and his wife, and we go out, and I wanted a steak. So they told me there's no place in Winnipeg to get a steak on a Sunday night. There's just no meat. Well, I said I was going to have a steak, so I walked into a Salisbury house. I forget where it was now, and I walked in there, and I said to the girl, "I wanted a steak." He said, "I'm sorry, sir, you can't have a steak." There's an older lady sitting behind the bar. She says, "Oh, yes, he can have anything he wanted." So they says, "How big a steak?" I said, "I want a couple good-sized steaks." So everybody else just had to have a sandwich, but I had two big steaks, and everybody in the restaurant watched me eat these steaks. Of course, when they found out where I come back from, there was nobody there. She said, "Give him another one if you can eat it." So I had everybody behind me, but then we were, of course, went to barracks the next day. I was given extra rations, butter rations, anything we wanted. We could go take it home to our family or money, go down and buy as much meat and potatoes, in the those rations. We were given 3 or 4 times as much as we actually needed for the family. But well, we were quite hungry that time. We had it all.
And when did you get your discharge?
I was the first Winnipeg Grenadier, and I wanted my discharge that took on December the 19th, 1945.
And when did you return to work?
I went to work 2 days after I got, I went to work on the 21st of December for the CPR shops. And believe it or not, I went back to shoveling coal and worked in the powerhouse at the railway. And then one day I wasn't feeling too hot, and I was standing down there and smoking a cigarette. My dad, my uncles, my whole family worked for CPR at that time. And a fellow by the name of Leo George was the general manager of the CPR at that time, and Lenoski was the manager of the other shops. Leo George was general manager. And when they come down, everybody started running around to make sure they're working. Of course, I just stood there and I smoked a cigarette, and Leo George walked by me, and I always remember his name. He says, "Do you like it here?" And I said, "No, your goddamn job stinks." So I walked over and I punched the time clock. And I walked out, but I went home that night. I went home that afternoon. My mother didn't say too much to me, and I'm sitting around there. Of course, my dad came in the house. He said, "What the hell did you quit the railway for?" So I got pretty nasty to my dad at that time. I said, "Well, your buddy was supporting me. I'll let you know why I quit anywhere." I said, "Until you do, this is my goddamn business." Well, my dad saw that I was pretty well upset at the time. He didn't say any more. This is in January. So I said to him, I said, "Oh, I feel like a beer." That's why the beer downstairs. I said, "Oh, I'll go down to the hotel." So I think my mother and my dad to go with me. And my dad just kind of come with you. I said, sure. So I went downtown. All the boys were sitting around drinking beer, partying, walking there. You throw a couple of dollars underneath the glass. And you sit there all afternoon and all night and you drink. The more they come in, that the mom will tell you, just line up a table and everybody sat down there. By this time, I'd already proposed to my wife. We were getting married on the 19th of January. And, you know, Christ, I'm getting married and I had my discharge in the Army. What the hell am I going to do? Well, I think I figured, well, I'm not going to hang around the beer parlor drinking all the time. So I went and got another job. It was, what the hell am I doing? I'm working what they call metallizing at McDonald Aircraft. Well, I walked in there, and I was over there about 4 days, and I finally found out the foreman was, to me, he was like an Army man. Every time he told you to do something, he's like a sergeant in the Army. You do this, right away, I want it done. So one day, I was standing, I looked at my ass, and I says, were you in the Army? He says, yeah. I said, I was. I said, what rank were you? He says, I was a sergeant. He said, I was a sergeant. He says, by the way, he said, get over there and do that. I said, don't worry, I just kiss my ass, I'm not doing anything. So I quit there. And by this time, I'd been married. Well, geez, I got to find myself another job. So I went, this time I went to work for the city of Winnipeg. So I went out working, laying concrete on the streets. I had no easy job when I come home. I wanted my discharge from the Army, I got it. So I went out. Then by this time, laying concrete, I took pretty sick. I went in the hospital. I went into Deer Lodge, and in Deer Lodge for about 3.5 months. With my disability and warm, my feet were bothering me, my legs were bothering me, I just felt the hell, and I went in there, and I was in there 3.5 months. Well, I went into the hospital. The doctor said, what's wrong with you? I said, I don't know, you're getting paid to tell me what's wrong with me. So he looked at my friend and said, you're a Hong Kong veteran. I said, yeah. And he said, well, we better put you in the hospital for a while. I stayed in the hospital for a while. Started getting his vitamin shots. This is all they could give you. They didn't know what the hell to do. They didn't have a doctor that understood what was wrong with the Oriental disease. They had no man qualified to answer it. Then I come out of there and I transferred to still work with the city. One thing, I went to work for the emergency house in the shelter, which they had the old airport out there. Which Bristol Aircraft have got all that area in there. Now that I worked there as stokers and just general maintenance out there. Well, then I just come to 19th, just before the flood there, I went into hospital. The year before that, I went into hospital. I was in the hospital, in Deer Lodge Hospital, over 1 year. And they were trying all the treatments on me. I could freeze my feet, and I wouldn't even know my feet were frozen because they were no feeling in the legs whatsoever. So I went into Deer Lodge, and I decided that they were going to give me defective treatments on my feet to make sure that they would, the feeling would come back, and which they didn't do a damn bit of good, which I told them it wasn't. And then they said, okay, we'd have to do an operation on you. So anyway, the flood come on, and I've been out of hospital, full pay and allowance. In the meantime, I'm supporting my oldest daughter, one child at that time, and then wife was expecting another one. And then I left, stayed there for about 2 months, and went back in and had the operation, which I goddamn really died from. I stayed in another hospital, another year, 2 years I was in the hospital with a crack. So I went back to work for the city of Winnipeg. This time I was getting 15% disability work pension, which at that time amounted to $35 a month. So I couldn't retire on that. I couldn't do nothing. I had to get off of work. So I was paying rent and supporting my family. So I went out to the city of Winnipeg, and then I thought to myself, well, you're a goddamn fool for working this hard. So I was told to stay off my feet when I got my discharge in the hospital. I wasn't to work 8 hours a day. I wasn't do any heavy labor. I was just to put everything in general. They gave me a big 10% increase in my pension, which gave me 25% of a disability pension, which comes to $61 a month to support a family and pay rent.
I thought this was really good. So I went down and applied for a job at General Bakers. And the guy looked at me and he said, yeah, you think you can handle them? I said, yeah, I can handle them. So I went down there and I worked. I worked there about a year, and I was promoted to from a retail delivery house to house. I was promoted to a wholesale, which was a promotion at that time. And I was making good money at that time. I'd make myself $103 a week back in 1950, 51, 52, which was damn good money. And then I worked there and I took sick. I went back to the Deer Lodge Hospital and stayed there for another 3 weeks. Nothing happened. You're okay, you can leave hospital. So I went back to work and still went back to work. And one day the boss come to me and says, we're making you a supervisor. I said, no way, I want to be a supervisor. I said, imagine you too much being a goddamn sergeant in the Army. And he said, this is fine, it's entirely up to you. So in the meantime, I was telling them I was making $20 a week more than the supervisors were at the bakery, but my whole service that I have. Because at this time, I can become a pretty good salesman. And then the word come through from the head office in Toronto that I'd have to take the job as a supervisor. So I went and saw the general manager at that time. I said, fine, I'll take the job, provided you give me the same wages I'm making on my roof. Well, he said, this is fine, but don't tell the other supervisors. So I went there as supervisor retail. And during that year, I became the chief retail supervisor, which I climbed over the other three supervisors were there. And he said, we better put you in charge of wholesale. I go to wholesale, because I need a supervisor in the wholesale department. So I went into the wholesale division again. And then I become the chief supervisor of wholesale with less than a year. This time I was getting pretty fed up with in general. So I decided I needed a change. So I went left there, went and got a job at selling cars. And it was the biggest mistake I ever made in my life. Anyway, I didn't do too bad there, and then one day I was talking to the guy from the freight press, which he knew, the same lodge as I did, and he said, what's going on? He said, I'm looking for a man. I said, what doing? He said, district manager. I said, well, I might as well give it a try. So I went there, I was making about $600-$700 a month selling cars in 1955-56. I went there and I started there at $250 a month, something different. Well, I never looked back on it since then. I went there in 1955, I've been there ever since. I'm supervisor there of the circulation department, in which I hold a pretty good job today.
Okay, now we'll go back and get some personal experiences, like escape attempts or anything like this, from a prison camps.
Yeah, you know, it's a strange thing about this. During my Army career, I was a guy that was always into trouble. Anytime he told me I couldn't get out of a camp, I found a way to break out of camps in Winnipeg here. I knew how to break out of Fort Ogden barracks. I got down to Jamaica, I knew how to get out of the barracks down there, and I would be AWOL. I'd be AWOL for 3 or 4 days, and anybody looking for me, there he goes again. When I was in San Francisco and I got to Hong Kong, I managed to find a way out the first night I was there. So one day, after we were taking prisoner of the war, one of the sergeants said to me, Red Windsor, our true friend called to Bun Windsor, he said to me, he says, well, he says, this is one camp you're not going to get out of. So I says, I said, don't worry, this is fine. I said, Red, I said, I can get out of this camp. I can't get out of it. So he said, well, how are we going to prove it if you did get out of this camp? I said, when I go, I said, what do you want me to bring you back? He says, you know, he said, the last year we were around, he said, was on Mount Cameron. He said, when you had some stuff up there. I says, right. He said, you know where it is? I said, yes, I know where it is. There's about a dozen guys sitting around there. He said, I'll bet you $50 that you can't get out of here and bring that stuff back. I said, well, you got $50? He said, no. He says, but he says, I've got 15 anyway. They scrounged up amongst $50 by themselves, and I had the money because I'm quite a gambler, shooting crap and playing cards. So I had the money, so I put the money up. And so I didn't say nothing to anybody. That night, they used to have what they call a banjo, which they call a bathroom here. You have to have that built up over the seawall. Just below that seawall, there was what they call a drain coming from the mountain down, and you could walk up this drain and you could come. At that time I didn't know where it come out. I knew it had to come out somewhere. And the tunnel, it was like a tunnel, was quite large. You would have to stoop over to walk through it. So I made my way out that night, and the Jap guard was looking, and I dropped down and got in this tunnel and I started walking. I couldn't see a goddamn thing. It seemed that I walked for hours and I didn't know it. Finally, when I come up behind, I found that I was right behind the Cap Carmen in his house. By this time, I was pretty scared. I thought, well, geez, what a stupid bet to make. Anyway, I got up, as I was going up here, I started picking up different stuff, food and bully beef that was thrown around the hill that we didn't know where it was. So I took this, and I opened a can, and I had a damn good feed. So when I got this package that we had, put it on my back and bought it back with some other stuff I bought. I had picked up and brought it back. I come back into camp and I come up the hill and the Jap guard standing right beside the latrine. So I watched him and he finally moved off and a couple of guys come to go to the bathroom there and I says, hey, where's that Jap guard? And everybody started and I said, don't look down here, just keep facing where you are. And one guy said, Christ, is that you, Dolly? Yeah. So finally I come up and I had this parcel, so I went back over the hut and next morning Red Winter says to me, I threw this stuff on it and everybody come in pretty quiet and I put this stuff underneath. I was always right on my feet at that time and I hid the stuff underneath where I was sleeping and next morning they're all sitting around, they're all laughing. Well, one of these days you're allowed to break out and get that stuff. So the heifer and rice was served for breakfast. Somebody says, you're going out for some rice? I said, no, you can have my share this morning. So one of my three of the four of them went back in. I had this can of bully beef and some hardtack and some stuff out, and I was eating it. Where the hell did you get that? I said, well, you better ask Red Windsor when he comes in. Of course, Red Windsor comes in and takes a look. He says, where the hell did you get that? So I threw the pack. I said, here's the pack. He says, I bet you did go out last night. I said, yes, I did. This time, I got word got around the camp that I'd had gone out, and I got shit from the officers for going out. Because they've already signed a paper that nobody should attempt to escape from the prison camp, which I thought was a lot of horse shit. If you didn't sign it, the Japs beat you up. So I guess it was about a week later, a guy by the name of McFarland, called Spanky McFarland, a guy by the name of Corporal Blumen. He says, when are you going out again? And I said, I don't know. I never even thought about it. And they said, they'd like to go out and see what they could find. We had all this food and they'd take pretty good shows. I went out another time, and we managed to come back with some more food. Well, the third time we went out, wasn't very successful because the Chinese at this time had a couple of yarns pretty good, they picked up all the stuff and come back empty handed the third time I broke out of the camp. The fourth time I was going to break out with Brudinsky in pain, I took malaria. I couldn't go, and I guess God must have been on my side because they were both captured and both shot. Otherwise, I'd have been there with it. I had to pick malaria. There was no change in plans at that time. Well, this is my experience of the war. But we had a good bunch of NCOs. The junior officers were good. The senior officers, I wouldn't spend on the best part of the week today.
Do you think the Canadian government has treated you fairly since the war?
Well, it depends what you're talking about since the war. From 1945 to 1964, the answer would be no, definitely not. The Canadian government didn't give a shit for any veteran. And they could get out what they should have done when we brought them home in 1945. Just put us all into some place. I found out what was the matter with the especially the expedition that come back from Hong Kong. When you were living on a diet we were living on, there was no way that anybody was going to tell us what to do. I think the Canadian government took it and told us that they wanted to do this, put us away into a barracks, took us out to a country somewhere and put us there and give us all that had physical medical. When I got my discharge, I went through there and the doctor just tapped my chest. He says, you're okay, you're discharged A1. And I wasn't going to argue at that time that I was A1 or AB or whatever you want. I just wanted out of the goddamn army. Well, I was very fortunate that in the First World War, my dad was in there, and he was wounded quite badly, and he understood how much trouble he had fighting for a pension. I said, the doctor said, look, I told him I discharged, but I'm not A1. So he says, okay, you have 30 days after your discharge to go to the Air Lodge to a pension commission to make your own, which I did do, and I qualified for 15% pension. This is fine. As long as I got my foot in the door, I knew that I explained my position to them, what was wrong with me. That then it did happen, I had a case to go back in, which I did. So, and I went through this, and I was 6 years on and off. In 1952, just after I went to the bakery, I come back out, and I complained about this operation they did. It didn't help any, and what bothered me when I was in the hospital, why they kept me in 2.5 years, and why I'd only got a 10% boost. Then I started arguing my own case, and they raised me to 50% disability pension. This is in 1952. And then I thought to myself, when I was a member, an executive member of the Hong Kong Vets Association in 1946 when we first formed, I'd become one of the executive members. Well, we used to have, when the association was first formed, it was going to be just nothing but a social club. We'd get together once a year and have a reunion. We'd meet maybe once a month and have a few beers and have a hell of a good laugh about, you know, the good times we had in the prison camp. Well, I wasn't satisfied with this. I thought, what the hell was this? So in 1952, I started getting them, after I got my 50% pension, I thought, well, we need 50% pension across the board for all Hong Kong vets, which I proceeded to do, and I became the branch president then. And I fought for this. I went down to Ottawa. I had a good many arguments with doctors down in Ottawa. And in 1956, we formed a national association, the Hong Kong Veterans Association. Well, we elected our first president, a fellow by the name of Colin Standish from Sherbrooke, Quebec. Well, he stayed from 1955-56 to 1958. He wasn't doing a goddamn thing. He wasn't arguing. I was still arguing about this 50% disability pension, complete medical checkup for all our boys once a year at hospital, which the government wasn't doing. So then we had the national convention was held in Winnipeg. We elected a fellow by the name of Lionel Hurd was elected the next president. He lasted 1 year, and we felt that the job wasn't going to be done. So then I went to a convention meeting, and I happened to be elected as the national president of that clinic. Well, when you become the national president, you have to start thinking a new idea and raise men to try and get something from it for your funding. Well, at that time, I was very fortunate. I had a good, terrific secretary by the name of Bob Lytle, a man that could really write letters, and he explained to him what you wanted, and he could put him down in detail. He's just as good as a lawyer. So he did this, and we took our briefs to Ottawa, and we started fighting him. But we found out here by this time, in Deer Lodge in Winnipeg, and we had a few men that went there years ago, and they left a bad taste in Deer Lodge's mouth. It wasn't the way that they were handling things, the way that they were saying things. They were banging their fists on the desk demanding this. One this time I didn't know it, so I went up to Deer Lodge, and we got a hold of Dr. Vince McKenty, which is a head pension doctor. He'd been for years, and I found out he was a very fair fellow. We presented a good number of cases before him, and he had the man called into the hospital and given a report, and found out the man were getting increase in pensions. Well, very fortunate in Winnipeg, by this time our men started getting glasses, they need them, they're getting all their teeth fixed. So in 1962, I went back to convention and said, this is what the men are getting in Winnipeg, and they were there flabbergasted, but no, they wouldn't recognize teeth the rest across Canada. The government said, no way can the teeth or your eyes be affected. So we argued with the government, and still was no good. So in 1963, we went back to Ottawa again, not getting anywhere with the Standing Committee on Veterans Affairs. Many times when you had the Liberals in and you had the Conservatives in, and they were just a matter of the political football. when one would get into power, they said, what are we going to do about the Hong Kong vets? And they said, well, we can't do nothing. We'd have to, you know, have them down here for a brief. Then this thing would carry on. Then the man that was in power as prime minister would get up and say, what are we going to do about the Hong Kong vets? Yeah, but he was in power. He didn't do anything. So then we approached, we had a very good friend on our side at that time by the name of Jerry Mann, who was the chief of special services in Ottawa. He was giving us a hand. Show us how to maneuver through the Department of Veterans Affairs down in Ottawa, how to get in and see different doctors, which we did. Then an idea struck us. We took a brief to the Standing Committee of Veterans Affairs, demanding we get 50% across the board, and we said, we can prove to you that we're in worse shape than our brothers that were served over in Europe. So this became Bert Herridge, which is a member of Parliament for the Scrutiny BC. He was very interested in it, and we had a few others who were quite interested at that time, and they started carrying the ball for us. They turned around and made a recommendation to the Standing Committee of Veterans Affairs that Dr. Richardson be appointed to survey the works of the Hong Kong Vets, to take the Brothers Survey, which he did. In 1965, he completed his recommendations were for the House. The pensions were far too low for the Hong Kong veterans. Well, they were called in, and some were getting reboarded, some were assessed on their files, a number of complaints that they had. And I went from that time from 50% up to 80% disability pension. And I was one of the, not one of the first ones to get a raise, but when I did get it through, I got a 30% increase in pension. We had fellows who were sitting at 10%, went up to 70% increase in their pension, found that the disability is warranted just after Richardson's survey. So then we had still had a lot of fellows that were under the 50% disability pension. Of course, we hammered home again, and then Roger Tully was elected the Minister of Veterans Affairs. We took a case before Roger Tully, which Roger and I were quite show me the allegiance at this time were getting behind us and supporting the Army Navy, were supporting all veterans organizations. We get behind the Hong Kong veterans and giving us their support. Up to this time, to Richard's report, they would no way would they come forward and give us their help. But as soon as Dr. Richard got behind, they all jumped on the bandwagon to help us, which they did. So in 1966, the Woods Commission was formed. This another political football took about 2 years before they finally got on air, and then the recommendation was made that all Hong Kong veterans get 50% disability pension. Well, we're quite happy today that all our men, if they happen to them, their wives automatically receive the full disability pension. But actually the fight was still not over yet, because we different things that the government don't recognize. They don't recognize heart conditions. And this is aggravated one-third by the war. Now, what the hell do I mean by one-third? In the meantime, you had a heart condition, you acknowledge in your files it aggravated by the war. Or you had it before you enlist. And I said, how the hell do you have it before you enlisted when you're in A1 shape when you join the Army? And I said, then this shows on your file. But I think that we're proving our point to the Canadian government, but we didn't get a fair deal at all when we come back home. Where just the promise that they made in 1939, we'd join the Army, we'd look after the veterans, and a bunch of bullshit. You might as well not bother going to war when I look at what they've done, what Germany have done, and they're living better than we are, and they lost the war in Japan and striving to do more business than the unemployment in Canada for what they're doing for losing the war. We'd have lost the war, we probably would have not been as well off as they are. I think one of the Canadian government is thinking of pouring money into Japan and Germany and doesn't give a shit about their own veterans here in Canada. They're turning around and putting all these hospitals under the university, turning them over to the government for university purposes. They did this at Sunnybrook. Found out it's not working. The veteran can't even get into the hospital because they got so many of the other people in there with the other disabilities at the bottom because they're paying people. They're not interested in the veteran today. When Doogie, the Minister of Veterans Affairs, gets up and makes a speech, make love, not war. And I think this is idiotic for the Minister of Veterans Affairs to address this at a veterans group. That's my feeling on the Canadian government today.
Has your opinion of the Japanese been affected any by the war?
They were when I first came home. I don't hold any of them much. They went to Japanese today. I looked at it, but they were believed, they were fighting for what they believed in, and I was fighting for what I believed in. And probably we had men that treated the Germans just as bad as the Japanese treated us. I don't know. I honestly couldn't answer you. But after all, they're human, and I'm human too. So you have to take it. It wasn't their fault. They believed in the government at that time. The various of the people who get the book, Knights of Bushido by Lord Russell, and read that book. I think a lot of them get a good education in reading that book.